I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. A new book looks at the prayers offered at the opening of each session of Congress, in particular when offered by guest chaplains of the Jewish faith. When rabbis bless Congress, the great American story of Jewish prayers on Capitol Hill offers insight into the practice and tradition of the invocation, the politics within the institution of the American House of Representatives and Senate, as well as gets the reader thinking about whether prayer has a place in the public realm, even though the idea of the separation between church and state is as old as the Republic itself. If you're a history buff, the book is an engaging look at the sometimes tenuous partition between governing and faith. The book's author, Howard Mortman, who joins me now, profiles the over 400 rabbis who have delivered prayers over the 160 years or so since the first rabbi was invited. The book is also a great introduction into American Jewish history, thanks to his look at these distinguished religious men and women. It's unlikely that prayers in the legislative bodies of the United States will disappear anytime soon. It goes back to the Continental Congress. Yet the idea of how faith shapes the United States hasn't been looked at in this way heretofore. Howard Mortman is Communications Director for C-SPAN, the public service providing television coverage of the United States Congress. He is of the Beltway, if you will, someone who's worked in and around Washington, D.C., whether in the media at MSNBC, National Journal's Hotline, as well as in politics on a presidential campaign, as well as an appointee in the Department of Housing and Urban Development. He is a graduate of the University of Maryland. His Twitter handle is at Howard Mortman. This new book is published by Cherry Orchard Books. Please welcome to the Plante Online program Howard Mortman. Mr. Mortman, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Joe. Thank you for having me with you.
Thanks for joining us. So I was telling you just as we started how much I enjoyed the book because it tells a story about your country and its relationship with Jews. It also talks about these institutions like the House and the Senate, the wider world as well, you know, whether it's wars or the Holocaust, space even. What was the impetus to look at this subject as closely as you have?
Right. Well, that's the essence of this. Like, why would anybody write a book about rabbis who pray in the United States Congress? The bigger picture is the story of prayers in the U.S. Congress. Much more broadly, has never really been written before, talked about. The impetus, to answer your question more directly, is I work for C-SPAN, and C-SPAN is the television network in the United States that shows the U.S. Congress, the House and the Senate, the floor, live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Congress. And I'm the communications director, so that means I'm basically the PR guy for C-SPAN. So as a result of my job, I watch a lot of C-SPAN. I watch a lot of Congress. You know, there's, as you and your audience probably know, there's always a lot of fighting and partisanship and bickering and debates. But one thing that always, just as a curiosity, always struck out to me is the very beginning of each session of Congress opens with a prayer, opens with the House of Representatives or in the Senate. There's a chaplain, and the chaplain gives a prayer. They do that even before they do the Pledge of Allegiance. The American flag. It's the very first thing they do, and the tradition goes back to the very beginning of the creation of America back in the 18th century. So just as an institution, I'm just curious about this practice. On occasion, the official chaplain of the House and the official chaplain of the U.S. Senate are not there, and they have substitutes, like a substitute comes in and opens each session with a prayer. Mm-hmm. That happens on some occasions, and then on even rarer occasions, that guest chaplain is a rabbi. And that's where my story begins. I'm Jewish, and so when there's a rabbi who gives a prayer in Congress, I've always perked up a little bit.
And you mentioned the tradition and practice in terms of what happens during the proceedings. You know, that's a source of discussion itself as to whether there should be prayer in an institution like the House or the Senate. But courts have ruled on public prayer, have they not?
Yes, so that's a great jumping-off point because that's actually, that looms over this whole project is a whole broader issue of, in America it's called the Establishment Clause, the freedom of religion, but in practicality, church versus state. You know, this is not without controversy, the practice itself of opening prayer, opening Congress or any legislative session in prayer. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled several times that it is allowed. Legislative session, city council, state assemblies can open with a prayer. So that's very much part of the whole issue. But my book and what my research, what I've tried to do is ignore all that. I don't care about the debate over church versus state. What I care is just this, the history, the tradition of opening Congress in prayer and looking at the rabbis just from an historical perspective, who they are and what they've said.
Yeah, so we'll get into that in just a sec. But the other thing that I was wondering about as I was reading the book is how often is your anthem sung in the House or the Senate?
You mean the
national anthem.
Well, it's actually, you know what, I've not had that question before. I don't believe it's ever been sung. They do have the Pledge of Allegiance that opens each session to the U.S. flag, but there's no singing involved. That's not even occurred to me before. I can't even think of any time. I mean, there might have been singing on occasions, but nothing as I will admit my ignorance here. Is that a Canadian tradition?
Well, I looked it up because I noticed when I watched our version of C-SPAN, CPAC here in Canada, they do open the session with a prayer as well. It's usually conducted by a member of the parliament. And then once a week they do sing the national anthem, and they brought that in, I guess, in the mid-90s or the mid to late 90s when separatism was a big deal in this country. And they decided to let's put that. And it was not without controversy either because, you know, there were people who were opposed to having to, especially the separatist party, they would say not enter the chamber until the anthem was sung.
As an amateur novice historian, that's fascinating. I actually would love to learn more about that. That's so interesting. Thank you for sharing that. I didn't know any of that.
So the other thing that struck me, Howard, as I was reading the book is you know, I'm a fan of history and politics, not just of my own country, but obviously yours, because I've watched C-SPAN over the years, as you know. The book seems like it's a lot of hard work having to, say, mine the archives, not just of C-SPAN, but, say, news clippings and the sort. But at the same time, it seemed like a lot of fun, was it?
Boy, what a perfect question. Yes to both parts of that. This is the classic work of passion, the classic passion project where, you know, let me answer your second part first. It's fun because no one's ever done this before. No one's ever research the history of prayers. Again, they might have talked about should there be prayers, but they never really sat down and said, well, let's just look at who said this stuff. So fun, but in a way daunting, because I have to get it right. I mean, there's no fact-checking in this. I mean, this is since I'm a pioneer in this kind of research, you know, it just that's where the exhaustive going through records comes to play. And that comes to the first part of your question. Yes, this involves a heck of a lot of don't tell my family, but a lot of 2 a.m. coming down to the computer and pouring through all the C-SPAN video that goes back to when C-SPAN was created in 79 and before that through what's called the Congressional Record. And in American, that's where all the proceedings of Congress are recorded, and that goes back to 1860. So I basically went through every single prayer ever spoken in Congress back to the 1860s and went through them all and tried to figure out who were the rabbis, and if I spotted a rabbi, it was a big eureka moment, and I added it to my Google Sheets, Excel sheet, and created the first ever. There have been over 400 rabbis who have given over 600 prayers in the U.S. Congress. The reason why those numbers are different is because several rabbis, maybe 100 of them, gave two or more prayers. So that's why. Yes, that's why the difference. But I've recorded on my iMac computer, on my Google Sheets in here, every single rabbi, what they said, who sponsored them, a member of Congress, what party the sponsors were the rabbis male or female, just all the different subsets of that.
So it might surprise some listening to us that it took until 1860, pardon me, for a rabbi to, appear in the House. But at the same time, it might surprise some people that it's as early as 1860.
Perfect, perfect. That's the best way to explain it, because it's, yeah, on one hand, well, what took so long, on the other hand, that's kind of fast. And on the other hand, being that's fast is because the tradition of a guest chaplain didn't actually begin until the 1850s. Mm. So if the first chaplain prayed in Congress in, you know, 1770, in 1780s, the first guest chaplain didn't appear until 1850s, and it was a decade later the first rabbi. So you can look at it either way, what took so long, or, you know, it just took 10 years. I will say, though, that after the first rabbi, it was a while before the second one came. It was kind of a shock to see a rabbi, a Jew, in the center of Congress, and there was even the reports of the media reports were quizzical and puzzled by the appearance of, I believe the New York Times called it, a Jew wearing costume and in the front. So, you know, you have to put yourself back into what Americans thought back in the 1860s of different people. So it was a while before the next one came on the scene.
Yeah, that's the other fascinating part is how the media reports on these appearances. You can see from 1860 on just how Jews are viewed in America. I mean, there are moments in history where the patriotism of Jews has been questioned over the years, and Jews being the subject of scorn and cynicism, outright hate at some points in your history, right?
Definitely so. In fact, I bring that out in the book. I do. There were flat out blatant anti-Semites, racist anti-Semite bigots in the U.S. Congress. Not a proud moment, but they have to be. You know, they have to be cited as part of the history. Who doubted Jewish patriotism? Who doubted? Who would just make classic anti-Semitic stereotypes about Jews? And this is from members of Congress. I would say, despite that, the tradition of rabbis praying in Congress continued. But that's definitely, you know, this is, as we all know, the, you know, history reveals a lot of bad things as well as the good stuff. And, yeah. But I, you know, didn't want to hide any of that.
So the rabbis that have appeared in front of Congress to offer the prayer, you write about all of them in your book. A lot of them are distinguished in their field. A lot of them, in their community, obviously. I guess that begs the question as to how they're chosen to be a guest chaplain. I guess if you are a distinguished rabbi in one city, you would eventually get an invitation, say?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, because that now we're bringing the broader concept of small p politics into this. In practical terms, the most typical way of a rabbi, I'll say this for not just rabbi, but for any man or woman of the cloth, to be chosen, selected as a guest chaplain in Congress, typically it's a local member of Congress or a U.S. senator who sponsors him or her. Mm-hmm. Again, we're not limiting this to rabbis, just in general. So typically, the member of Congress will sponsor the guest chaplain. It's typically someone who's commonly known in the community, maybe a big synagogue or a big church. They have been imams, representing mosques. So it's a big deal to be selected for this honor. It's a big deal a big deal for the rabbi. It's a big deal for the member of Congress to be associated with a learned, beloved figure in the community. These aren't necessarily donors or campaign donors, but just respected leaders of flocks, influential people. So that's typically how they are selected, by the local members sponsoring them. And then they get up, they offer the prayer, the guest chaplain offers the prayer, and then the member who sponsors him or her then gets up and makes maybe about a minute or so remarks in tribute to that rabbi, that guest chaplain, and saying how great that person is, how moving that prayer was, and their role in their local state or local city.
Mm-hmm. And have you've obviously looked at the contents of these prayers, the words used, the words spoken. Are there rules as to what one would say?
There are rules. The rules have evolved. They've changed over the years. The rules as they stand now is In general, your remarks are geared toward God. They're not geared toward individual members, but kind of directing the members toward God in their prayers. In general, they're not supposed to get involved in policy or politics, even though they may give prayers at times of great debates. They're not supposed to really comment on pending legislation. You can't use foreign language, meaning in the case of rabbis, you can't use Hebrew, although the rabbis and subset rabbis used to speak Hebrew in their prayers. So these are kind of newer rules. And you can't mention another country, and you can't but the number one guideline or rule is that you have to recognize that there are many different faiths that you are addressing. So even though this is a little tricky, but even though it's a religious prayer, uh-huh. It's not an overtly religious, like evangelical kind of message. It has to be inclusive for many different faiths.
There is a part of the book, though, where you talk about the, say, the politics of Israel, and that has gotten evoked in prayers, hasn't it?
Yeah. So that, for me, this is actually kind of an interesting moment. When I set out to really investigate not only who these rabbis are, but what they've said, one of the initial markers for me was, well, it's kind of a looming thing, an obvious thing as well. Do they talk about Israel? Just because that's the Jews are so associated with the Jewish homeland in Israel. I found, and this was, it was surprising to me when I found it. It kind of makes more sense now, and the more I think about it, but there's very little Israel talk. Maybe in the earliest days when Israel was a blossoming new country, there was more talk. But now Israel or Jerusalem or any of the traditional Israeli symbols or citations are rarely mentioned. Far more common is just citations and mentions of America, love of America, patriotism. It kind of makes sense because the you're not really supposed to cite a foreign country, so maybe the rules might be like that. But this in general, for anybody who thinks that rabbis get up there and just want to talk about Israel and have Congress support Israel, that's actually not the case, and very rarely is Israel mentioned.
In terms of the various sects of Judaism, you hear of Reform Jews, Conservative Jews, Orthodox Jews. Have they been equally represented?
Yeah, this is actually really interesting. They have been, and again, you're totally right. The three main traditional denominations of Judaism are Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform, and it's basically, those three divisions are in terms of observance, like how many, how truly, I don't want to put a judgment on this,
sure.
But how many of the commandments are followed. But basically, like, traditionally, Orthodox Jews are the most observant of the three branches. So, but what I found is that it really falls out roughly a third, a third, a third, the rabbis are Orthodox, a third Conservative, and a third Reform. And this brings an important point, there's no quotas. There's no one saying, well, this rabbi, guest chaplain, has to be an Orthodox rabbi, or this one has to be Conservative. It's very much of it's an organically developed breakdown. It's one of the strengths, I think, of just, of the government not saying, you have to pick this rabbi. I mean, in Israel doesn't open with a prayer. So, like, if your rabbi wants to pray, open a legislative session in prayer, and you're Israeli, you have to come to America and do it. But Israel is torn with battles over, who can speak for the Jews and who can pray and all that. So it shows what a small L liberal democracy can offer.
Are there particular books of the Bible that are, say, popular amongst rabbis in terms of what's cited, say?
Yeah, so I went through as part of my propeller head geek research of this, go through and try to determine in the broad category of what do they say in their prayers. I did identify books of the Bible that were mentioned and most frequently, and the most mentioned book is from Isaiah. Of all the books that were mentioned, most rabbis cited Isaiah. And there's a famous line, if your audience knows the prophets and knows what Isaiah said, the most commonly used one from Isaiah is Isaiah 2:4, and that's the one that talks about turning your spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not wage war against nation. A very peace-driven or freedom-driven kind of invocation. So that's the most commonly cited one, and that's actually throughout time, throughout the history of these prayers.
Yeah. By the way, the role of chaplain, that's obviously a taxpayer-funded role. They have staff and the sword. Have the chaplains primarily been Christian?
Yeah, so on a couple things, you're right. It's very important to note that these are, as you said, taxpayer-funded positions. They are voted on by the House and voted on by the Senate. They have staff, so they have offices. They've been always Christian. The current chaplains, there's never been a Jewish chaplain or like a Muslim chaplain. They've always been Christian. Father Conroy, Patrick Conroy, is the name of the chaplain in the U.S. House now, and he's a Catholic, a Jesuit, actually, and that's been rare. I believe he's only the second one. I may have that wrong. In the Senate, the chaplain, his name is Barry Black. He's a retired Navy chaplain, and he is a Seventh-day Adventist. So they get elected every time there's a new session of Congress. There's not much turnover. I think in the House, Father Conroy has been there going on 10 years now, I believe. And I think in the Senate, Barry Black, the Senate chaplain, has been there going on about 14 years or so. So it's not off. There's not a lot of turnover, but when there is turnover, typically it always has been a Christian getting the job.
So conceivably, a rabbi could have the position one day, right?
You know what? It's funny you say that because as a result of my doing this book, and I've talked to a lot of rabbis, just befriending them as a result of this project. This may or may not shock you or your listeners who are politically active, but there are a number of rabbis I come across who want the job and angle for the job, and it's one of these things where because the job rarely comes open, it's the biggest honor of all. So and there are several rabbis who I've met along the way in this project who fancy themselves to be the first Jewish chaplain of Congress. So I don't know when that will happen. I don't know if it ever will happen, but it's definitely, there are a couple rabbis who I can think of off the top who just want that job. So it's coveted, yeah.
You have to remind me, Howard, wasn't there a contretemps a few years ago with the previous speaker as to the resignation of a chaplain and then it was taken away? I think you write about it in the book, don't you?
Yeah, so in very brief terms, this was the former, when the Republicans controlled the House, again, Democrats control the U.S. House now, Nancy Pelosi is the speaker, but when Republicans controlled the House and Paul Ryan was the speaker, the Republican, didn't really care for the chaplain, Father Conroy, and essentially worked to get him fired. And I don't want to put my thumb down either on the scale of either side, but it roughly was that Father Conroy was getting a little more political in his remarks about the budget, about just political things, and I think Paul Ryan had enough of that. And so in the end, Father Conroy is still there and Paul Ryan is not, but every so often politics, the big P politics, does get involved in this practice, and that's people who don't want to see religion at all in their government, point to these kinds of things as examples of why you should just stay away from the whole thing.
There's one rabbi that I want to talk about, and I hesitate because there are obviously far more distinguished rabbis that you write about in the book. But I, as a history buff, I just found it fun. He's the fellow from Dallas who was he was Jack Ruby's rabbi, and offered an invocation at the trademark luncheon.
And then
on November 1963, and then he also officiated at Zapruder's funeral, and he offered a prayer, I believe, in the Congress. Did he not?
He did, and are you going to kill me? I'm blanking on his name right now.
Gerald Klein, is that right?
Yeah, Gerald. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, he's I love. Yeah, he was tangentially involved with the Kennedy story. I'm glad you picked up on that as history buff. After Robert Kennedy was shot, and before he died in 68, a rabbi, I think it was Rabbi, Metzger, from Illinois, I believe, gave the prayer, and Kennedy was still alive at that point. So, so that it was a wishful prayer for his survival. So, yeah, so yeah, these milestone moments in American history coincided with the intersected in some ways with the rabbi prayers. And I'm glad you picked up on that, because as a fellow history lover, just the connections, it's just so wonderful to see that.
So you mentioned that you're the communications director at C-SPAN. So how much of your day is spent watching the network?
Well, it really should be all of it. it's what we do, and you're a C-SPAN. I call you C-SPAN junkie, if you don't mind.
Indeed.
Our mission is, we are, first of all, it's very important that we are not government-funded. We are entirely privately funded, but we are a nonprofit, so we don't have advertising for our channel, so we don't have ratings. Our mission from the very beginning has been to show Congress and other activities involving policy and politics and policymakers around Washington, and we cover things around the country too, and just being able to allow the American viewers and Canadian and others, like you, to be able to just watch for yourselves what's happening in government, in the U.S. government, and to form your own opinions. We don't have reporters. We don't have people shaping the news or the narrative or editorializing. We have plenty of opinions, but not from us, the staff. It's from the people that we cover. And I will proudly bring CPAC programming on C-SPAN, like we show the British House of Parliament, the House of Commons as well. So that's we try to expose the American viewer to different governments, and we bring in that those sessions as well.
This is how great C-SPAN is, in that unfortunately in this country, this is about 5-6 years ago, I was researching something about election coverage in this country, and I couldn't find, obviously, long video clips of, say, election night coverage. And of all places where I found one election night that the CBC did was on the C-SPAN website.
That's pretty funny. Let me address that in a second, but I love that story, because I often find coverage of a Canadian election, but also British elections.
Right,
you bring in, like, the BBC coverage. You can't find on their site, but you can find on our site. There's a simple reason for that, is that we have put everything we've covered from the mid-80s, all of our video is available online for free, searchable and digitized through our C-SPAN archives, our video library. So I love that example of you going in and just finding something and using it. And, we want historians, we want reporters, we want students, we want everybody going in there and it's the entire history of our network that's available for free, basically in the stacks, in the video library. And that, for me, in writing this book, that was of enormous help, because then I could see these rabbis and what they look like when they're praying, where they were in a yarmulke. Raise their hands over the chamber like you would in a congregation? Just being able to see the video. Being able to interact with a video is just so much more rewarding than just reading transcripts. And just seeing for yourself is just a wonderful thing.
And the cover of your book reminds me, when I see the portraits of these distinguished rabbis, it reminds me of the image that we see on the videotape, say.
So you're just amazing. And you're saying everything I want to talk about. I love that, because two things. Yes, the cover is taken actually from screen grabs of C-SPAN coverage of these prayers. Again, the prayers are part of our coverage of Congress. So I went through and picked out 16 of them, gave it to an artist who created stylized images of them in black and white portraiture, and created this cover for the book. And I'm a complete amateur at this. I've never written before. I've always wanted to, and I've never done a book before. I've never sought a publisher before. So I just, a friend created, I said, here's kind of the vision. So I sent her 16 screen grabs of rabbis, and she created this stylized picture of it. I just was absolutely floored, and I have to admit to you and your audience, I cried, I sobbed a little bit out of happiness when I saw that. And one thing that it allowed me to do, it allowed me to not put pictures inside the book. And for me, that's a win, because like, how do you choose among all these rabbis whose picture? So, and also the mechanical costs drive the book, drive the cost of the publication up. So, so just the cover alone, really, for me, just was the essence of what I was trying to get across.
The talking about where you work for just a sec, because I obviously am a fan as a junkie. I've been thinking about history the last little bit, and I can't think, Howard, of a time. Perhaps you'll correct me. Where politics and popular culture has been as close as it is, and depending on the week, say over the last 4 years, they've been one and the same. I the other week on SNL, they opened the cold open was of a I can't remember what it was now, but they opened with the C-SPAN logo and then the voiceover. And, I had to laugh because, you're watching C-SPAN, which honestly is surprising. What is that, when you see the logo, say, as we all do on things like SNL, or you see it on late night TV and it's spoofed, if you will, that must be good for the brand.
You know what, you've nailed it. A couple things, we love it. I mean, high five, celebration. Say, hey, did you see SNL last night? So we, our modest, limitedly funded nonprofit operation, we just love that branding. Sure, they use it as a punchline, and I think the one you're citing, the most recent one, was they were showing a hearing where Rudy Giuliani
in Michigan.
So I think Michigan. Yes, so I think the line was something like, you're watching C-SPAN, or you can't believe you are, or something like that. And it's funny, but it's the same joke they've been telling for the years. So it doesn't really matter. It's just the fact that they put the branding on is really important. I mean, I don't want to make it too exalted, but it is important to maintain our relevance for people. We have found one subset of that in the pop, and I love your pop culture questions, but one subset is, when Hollywood makes movies about politics, they often look to us for licensing of footage, whether it's being able to license our logo or using footage from our video library and using that in their movies. I don't know why this example comes to mind, but Iron Man 2, there's a scene toward the beginning where he's Iron Man shows up at a hearing, and Gary Shandling plays the late Gary Shandling plays a senator, and so they do it in this kind of in the style of C-SPAN. They put a logo on, they have to do that. They have to license it, so they Hollywood does that to kind of add an air of authenticity to what they're trying to portray as politics, and movies like Bulwark. Bulwark.
The Warren Beatty one, yeah.
The Warren Beatty one. Yeah, they show what they thought would be a C-SPAN camera in there. They put the logo on that. A great Eddie Murphy movie, Distinguished Gentleman, showed a hearing at the end, and there is a Hollywood-manufactured C-SPAN camera. Back now, as a C-SPAN guy, all of them get it wrong, but that doesn't matter. As long as they get the logo right, that's okay.
I was just thinking, that's the next book, Howard.
Actually, that's not a bad idea.
C-SPAN in
Hollywood.
C-SPAN
in Hollywood, yeah. That's not a bad idea.
So in terms of how, I mean, you spoke a moment ago about ratings. You obviously don't but you do get a sense of how visible the brand is. People going to, say, watch the streams on YouTube or on the website itself, I mean, you must have a sense of, I mean, has it been more popular, say, these past 4 years than previous?
Yeah, boy, it's as if you work with us. sounds like you're in our meetings and going over this stuff. Brilliant. So, again, no ratings, and again, we don't have ratings because we are a nonprofit and we don't have advertising. So that's the reason why there's no ratings. To be consistent with that, we don't talk about our live stream numbers, meaning the live stream on our website, but, and here's the big but, you definitely can see the number of people as we are gingerly branching out and trying to get our footing right in the social media world of what we put on YouTube and Facebook clips, most popular clips. Sure, we can see, and these are all publicly available numbers. You can definitely see this heightened interest in our content. At the same time, you know, all of the media outlets are seeing or have seen great increases in numbers. Now, yes, you can see the last 4 years, Trump and all that. The problem is this problem of asserting that it's only Trump is that these numbers don't really exist for the time before Trump began.
Right.
I mean, the real monetization of video has just been an explosion that just coincided with Trump. So, yes, the numbers are good all around for that, but, you know, we'll see in the next 4 years how they, you know, how all the media is affected by the Biden administration.
Well, have you got an idea of what the most popular thing is? I mean, I look at your Twitter feed and I see, you know, like recently you tweeted the Patti LaBelle singing, which everybody has seen now, her without her backup singers, that clip. And I looked at the corner there and you can see a number. I mean, I don't think that's nearly as accurate because I've seen that, you know, on, say, other platforms of social media. Is there one clip in particular? I mean, I would think that that's got to be up there.
Yeah, so here's, okay, so I'll geek out on you a little bit. Here's what I love about my job, here's what I love about what the C-SPAN video does is, you know, if you are, let's say you're on YouTube, and let's say you find a video, and you say, boy, this is great, and then you share it, what you're basically doing is sharing, is you're finding video that someone else has already found. It's already been uploaded, and it's already been posted, and all you're doing is really moving it around a little bit. What I love to do, and this is where the C-SPAN video comes into play, is finding things for the first time, sleuthing it out. Now, Patti LaBelle is a great example of her not having her background singers at a Christmas tree lighting. I was not the first to find that, and you're right, there are many versions of that floating around, which is great. But when, you know, just as a video sleuth, be able to find something new for the first time and sharing that. And even, it's not even a numbers thing. You know, whether something gets 500 views or 1,000 views, you know, sure, you'd always want to get thousands, but even just a couple hundred, just being able to find bits of history and connecting Congress history with something happening right now, that's where, like, real joy comes in, real fun in finding this stuff.
Yeah, I love it when you post, say, you know, someone in the news and their first appearance, say, on C-SPAN or something like that. It just shows what an important archive, you know, C-SPAN is. It's essentially, I'm not the first person to say this, it's the history of America right there, at least, you know, the last 40 years or so, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. I mean, now, so we're at the point, and since you're a lover of history, this is so much fun to talk about. We're at the point now where everybody who Biden is picking for his cabinet has a huge video blueprint, a footprint in our archives. So you can really dig down and investigate. Like, you know, so over years, as we get more and more video of politicians, you can really see their first appearance, which goes back decades. So it's fun just to watch the accumulating collection of video as more, you know, and I've been doing this for a couple of decades. My own vantage point, you know, things that I remember from my past and being a lover of political history, you know, more things that I remember is on video than I can find. So, you know, it's not like you're going back and saying, I'm looking for old, you know, Eisenhower video, or Truman, which doesn't exist. But if you're looking for old Clinton or George H.W. Bush video, you can find that. It kind of matches your memories with what's there.
Yeah, indeed. Back to the book for a sec. You mentioned, you know, that you are Jewish. You know, I'm not asking you how Jewish you are, but in terms of your own faith, what has writing this book done for that?
Great, thank you. And I'm a Reformed Jew, and I belong to a Reformed Jewish synagogue, and grew up in Northern Virginia, where I live in the D.C. suburbs. My parents raised me as a Reformed Jew, so I'm part of that branch, that denomination. What this project has done for me personally, thank you for asking that. I've learned a lot, and that's going to sound very broad and almost trite, but there's a lot of elements of Jewish history and even Jewish prayers that I should have been aware of over these years, but I just wasn't, and it's filled in a heck of a lot of gaps. I have learned from rabbis who I've met along the way in this project who have taught me a heck of a lot of parts of Judaism and helped me from making mistakes, because, again, not only am I not a professional historian, I'm also not a rabbi. You know, like, if I didn't go to seminary school, so there's a lot of things I don't know that about which I'm writing. So I've had great friends guide me and say, you know, instruct me. So that's been the learning. I'll say another two other really important things for me, Congress history. So it's not just, again, not just a Jewish story. This is a story of Congress, the history of Congress. There are things that I found that, because no one has done this before, just connections with the congressional tradition has been a big part of this. And then finally, being Jewish out of this and just looking at the Christian community. Along the way, I've a number of pastors and non-rabbis who I've befriended, just interacting with them has been an incredible learning experience of, you know, their language and who they cite. And, you know, that's, you know, when Christians cite Old Testament or when rabbis cite New Testament, that interplay has been very interesting as well.
It's an endlessly fascinating book. I'm a lapsed Catholic, but I found a great deal that I enjoyed about the book in here. I mean, there's just so much. I mean, I could talk all day with you about this. In terms of the next book, have you thought of that, Sam?
Oh, gosh. How about more rabbis, more Congress? How about that?
The other thing I was wondering is, because you obviously watch C-SPAN, you know, it's a big part of your day. Do you prefer watching, say, the proceedings of the House or the Senate better? Which of the two?
What a great question. So I'm a big fan of the fall. I'm a big fan when they hold up charts and props. And so I love that stuff. They're really playing to me when they do that. So I there's more of that goes on in the House. So just on the visual elements, the House is sometimes more interesting. The Senate obviously is much more plodding, and you know, there's more stuff happening. You know, there's nominations, Supreme Court nominations, like weightier parts of history happen in the Senate. But boy, having to choose between the House and Senate, it's like having to choose between my two kids. So I enjoy them both.
So it made me think about our own proceedings in our House of Commons here in Canada and in other you know, legislatures throughout the country. You mentioned the charts. I don't know if it's a symptom of the watching the American system, but all props, for example, are banned in our Parliament. And the other thing I noticed, you see this when you see a senator speak in the U.S. Senate, you know, you see staff around them, obviously people who aren't members. No other persons are allowed on the floor. And you know, very rare exemptions are given for anyone who's not a member, say, to be on the floor. Again, just stuff that I've learned because I've been fascinated watching C-SPAN over the years and you know, seeing the various traditions.
That's so interesting. That's so true. I tell you what, you really should get involved in having them change that. I think many more people would be following the proceedings if there are things to look at. Shiny objects always work.
It's what you see on Twitter. It's what you see on YouTube, you know, or you know, you share it on Facebook or something like that. It's, you know, some member standing there with a huge chart it's just fascinating to look at the history, and you've done a marvelous job with your book. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed talking to you today, and I want to thank you publicly because a few years ago when I wanted Brian Lamb on this show, you were very helpful in getting that done. So I want to thank you for that as well.
Well, thank you, Joe. I actually remember that, and I remember how kind you've been, and it's gracious in your remarks about us, and boy, we just. You know, the fact that you're a serious lover of history, but also the fun side too, and that speaks volumes for your you know, for the value that you bring to your audience. So thank you for allowing me to join.
You're very kind. Thanks for this, Art. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
The Twitter handle is at Howard Mortman. The book is called When Rabbis Bless Congress, The Great American Story of Jewish Prayers on Capitol Hill. It is published by Cherry Orchard Books. Its author, Howard Mortman, joined me on the line from Washington, D.C. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plantum.